I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It starts with a simple mixing of air. Cold mountain wind from the west, that warm, humid breeze off the Gulf of Mexico. Then there's that moment somewhere on the great American plains when the two collide to form the roaring, destructive vortex that science has yet to fully understand, but all of us know as the tornado, the twister. The film Twister back in 1996 gave national profile to the practice of tornado chasing, that daredevil mix of science and madness that brings tiny little humans and their tiny little cameras and cars into the danger zone, what they call the bear's cage of the tornado. The cover story in the April edition of National Geographic has the photos and the story of people who got almost too close in South Dakota late last year. We've got a link to that story and to an amazing photo gallery on our website. We're at theconnection.org, and we'll talk to one of the men who was there. We want to have you give us a call. Have you ever had the urge to go see a tornado? Can ordinary people actually help the scientists better understand how and why tornadoes are formed? Or is it just a bizarre and dangerous form of thrill-seeking? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to start today's program with someone who, over the past 6 years, has become somewhat hooked on tornado chasing. Most of the year, David Lewison is a mild-mannered mechanical engineer in upstate New York. But for 2 weeks every year, Dave becomes a tornado chaser. He's joining us on the line. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. What made you ever think you wanted to see a tornado in the first place?
In the first place? Well, I've been interested in weather pretty much my entire life. And, growing up in New York, it's, you know, we see some thunderstorms, but we don't really see any the kinds of severe weather that you get out in the plains. So when I was in college, my senior year, I was just browsing around the web, and I came across a tour company, Cloud9 Tours, which was one of the first that I had ever seen that offers storm chasing tours. And I said, oh, I got to do that. So I signed up and basically been hooked ever since.
Where did you go then, Dave?
When I first started out, they're based out of Oklahoma City. And basically you fly out to Oklahoma City and drive around wherever is needed to find storms.
And you're not still with the tour company. You're doing it on your own now?
Yep, that's right. Basically, I went with the tour company for 2 or 3 years before I decided to try and strike it out on my own, and I've enjoyed it ever since. I go with my regular chase partner who's from Florida, and we meet out there every year and drive around.
Now, when would you be going this year? What's the season for you?
Well, for me, it's pretty limited now that I'm in the working world. I only get about 2 weeks of vacation every year, so yeah. I have to plan that accordingly.
But is this that year, May or June? What do you think?
This year it's going to be May 1st to May 16th, first 2 weeks.
You ever had a really close call with a tornado, Dave?
Well, I have to say that was both my first tornado and my first close call, I have to admit. It was back in 1998 when I was with the tours. Basically, we were chasing this storm up in northern Oklahoma, and it had produced a relatively picturesque tornado. It's not a classic, but it was what we call a truncated cone, basically a nice funnel up above with a big dirt plume below it. And that was the first one I had ever seen. But as we continued chasing it, it started to get towards nightfall. We thought the tornado and the storm was going to die soon after the loss of daytime heating. What we didn't know was that it had formed a new updraft base on its southwest flank. And so we had hidden in a hail shelter, basically, just to experience the hail and have a little fun. This was a little tin shed. And
These are the little tin sheds that I see getting tossed around by tornadoes, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So we parked in there just to have a little fun. And we didn't know that there was a F3 tornado about 3 or 4 miles to our west-southwest heading for us. But luckily, our tour guide, whose name is Jim Leonard, has had so much experience with this type of thing. He was able to read what was going on. Basically, the winds stopped and then shifted direction and out of the east, and he knew it was time to get out of there. And as it turns out, that tornado basically passed about an eighth to a quarter of a mile south of our location.
And just for people who aren't quite up on the lingo, because I'm only just learning, an F3 is rated on the Fujita scale as a severe tornado, winds up to 200 miles an hour. Babe, what's the point? Is it to just get a picture? Is it to feel the power of the wind that close? I mean, isn't this what the Weather Channel's for?
Well, some people, everybody chases for a different reason, honestly. Me, I do it just to experience it, and I also happen to love photography, so it seemed like a perfect match for me to bring a video camera and a still camera out there. Some people don't bring cameras at all. They just want to be able to see the phenomenon.
And one wasn't enough. You have to go back year after year. Right?
Well, for some people it is, but for me, once I saw that one, I had to keep going back and see what I can do every year.
Well, good luck in this year's travel, Dave. Thanks for being with us.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
David Lewison from Wappingers Paul, New York, one of the tornado chasers. Let's bring into the conversation now Dr. Lou Wicker. He is joining us from Norman, Oklahoma. He is research scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Severe Storms Lab, and he develops technology to improve scientists' ability to predict storms. Dr. Wicker, thanks for your time.
Glad to be here, Dick.
Now, I would have thought before I read my homework for this program that I'd be talking to you and you'd be saying, these damn storm chasers, they're in the way. I wish they'd stay, you know, I wish they'd stay away and leave this up to us scientists. But in point of fact, these folks are useful to you, aren't they?
Yes, I suppose around here in central Oklahoma, we sometimes get out there where there are 300 cars out chasing, and that gets a little bit crowded. You usually have to get a parking reservation ahead of time. But for the most part, I was a storm chaser as a student back in the early 80s and still enjoy it from time to time. But actually, the photo and particularly video documentation that storm chasers get usually captures very interesting and often very unique phenomenon. And we, as scientists and as, frankly, storm enthusiasts, most of us, are often fascinated by what they can show us.
Well, they are actually contributing to the science, aren't they? I mean,
yes, they are. I mean, a lot of what there's been a very interesting synergy between storm chasing and scientific efforts. Back when I started my undergraduate work here at the University of Oklahoma 20-some-odd years ago, storm chasing was considered by the scientific community as sort of an oddity or perhaps looked upon with scorn. But what's happened is that by consistently being able to go out and actually find tornadic storms and photograph and take video of the tornadoes, we've now moved to where the legitimate scientific funding agencies like the National Science Foundation and NOAA and some other organizations are willing to fund building mobile instruments to take them to the storms. And so we've turned storm chasing, in a sense, from sort of a hobby and sort of fascination and a visual learning environment into a quantitative environment where we take mobile vehicles and mobile radars and mobile mesonet stations and drive them around the storms and take actual measurements.
Actually, one of the people who is well known for his facility with those mobile instruments is going to join us now. Tim Samaras is perhaps one of the most celebrated tornado chasers. He's a senior research engineer for Applied Research Associates and a storm chaser for what, Tim, 20 years now?
I have actually been chasing probably 15-plus years, something like that.
And, in fact, it's your work in near Manchester, South Dakota, that's profiled in the cover story of this April's National Geographic with some amazing photographs. You realize you should be dead, right? I saw those photos.
Well, actually, you know, there's a lot of risks that one takes to try to get, you know, some of the measurements that are needed. Just because of the road network on June 24th, got me in a position where I really had no choice but to get in the path of this tornado, unfortunately rather close, and drop one probe and then quickly get out of the way.
Let's actually listen to the sound of you doing that. We have that from a piece of video, and it has that same power as listening to the film that we were listening to earlier in the program. Do we have that ready? Let's hear that.
I'm going to deploy another one. Let's go! Let's drop one more!
We need to drop one left a little bit.
Yeah, I know.
Because it seems to be traveling north.
And Tim, that was from the trip to Manchester, South Dakota, when you got so dangerously close to that one twister, right?
Yeah. Part of the audio was from our earlier deployment in what we call the Woonsocket tornado, which is a tornado that actually touched down just before Manchester, but it was all within about a one-hour period.
Now, the probes do what? What are these? I'll talk further in the program about some of the other stuff, but these little orange disks, what are they doing?
Well, actually, they've got little small recorders on the inside of them that record the barometric pressure drop, and I also can measure the temperature and moisture content of storms, too. And I can also calculate wind speed and wind direction, although only 3 inches above the ground. These probes are capable of doing that.
Let's go back to Dr. Wicker at the NOAA Severe Storms Lab. One of the things that surprises me, Dr. Wicker, is that there's still so much that's not known about where tornadoes come from and how it is they behave. Why is that?
Well, it's very difficult to get a complete picture of the storm. We can take these sort of point-wise measurements, as Tim's instruments do, or we can take a mobile Doppler radar out, or maybe it'll pad the storm will pass close to one of the conventional radars. But the problem is all these instruments only measure a little piece of the information that we need. One might measure the pressure at a point. The radar might sense the winds in one direction along the radar beam. But we're missing a lot of other ingredients. For example, there are really no instruments to directly sense the temperature and the rain and the humidity inside the storm, at least when there's no rain falling. And so basically what we always do is we get a partial snapshot of what's going on, and it's basically the job of science to try to fill in the rest of the pieces. And the fact is that tornadoes and rotating thunderstorms are very complex systems that don't necessarily reveal themselves easily to make it easy on us.
So is it just pure science? Is it that the desire to want to know, or is there something practical here? Could you actually, learn more about the way they're formed and maybe give people a better warning?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the wonderful thing about working in this field is that not only do I get to do what I love to do, but basically the things that we learn very rapidly can be translated into forecast improvements for the National Weather Services and other things. Our laboratory is fortunate to have the National Weather Service right across the street, and we talk to those people all the time about what we're thinking about and what ideas we're working on. And they also are very weather forecasters, and the people who look at the radars are very, very intuitive and very intelligent about what's going on in the storms from their perspective, and oftentimes from talking with them, I get ideas as well.
But you still like to chase tornadoes.
I still like to chase, although not as quite as rambunctiously, perhaps, as Tim does. I've had enough, one or two close calls when I was a little younger that kind of gave me, I don't mind standing back. It let him do the probes right in close there.
All right, Dr. Wicker, I know you have to go. I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Dick.
Dr. Lou Wicker is a research scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Severe Storms Lab in Norman, Oklahoma. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Do you have a hankering to chase tornadoes? Does this sort of thrill-seeking mixed with science appeal to you? 1-800-423-TALK. We'll come back and talk more with Tim Samaras right after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and I don't know about you, but I can get lost in something as simple as the Fujita scale, which describes what these things are like. Earlier in the program, Dave was talking about a severe tornado, an F3. They go all the way up to F6, and the language they use to describe that is what they call an inconceivable tornado with winds up to 379 miles an hour. My experience as a northerner with tornadoes isn't quite as organic as some people who might grow up in the Great Plains or in the Tornado Alley. I experienced my first tornado, I think, the way a lot of other people did as well.
Get them horses up. It's a twister! It's a twister!
Joining us on the program talking about tornado chasing is Tim Samaras. He is a senior research engineer for Applied Research Associates, has been chasing tornadoes for some 15 years. I don't know, does that have any place in your own history as a chaser?
Absolutely. In fact, listening to that little soundbite that you had brought me back when I was 8 or 10 years old listening to The Wizard of Oz. And I can still see that black tornado on television. And then after Dorothy's house was picked up and thrown in Munchkin Land, I slowly lost interest.
The tornado was the only interesting.
That was, in fact, that was the most expensive part of the entire movie, was the creation of that tornado.
There's something I didn't know. You've studied this well. Tell me, though, when you are out in really close to a tornado, how is it, Tim, that you make the judgment that this is safe and that's not safe? Because the limited understanding I have of these things is that the base of them, the part that's touching the ground, can whip around, can go in any one of 360 degrees without any notice at all.
Yeah, certainly there's a lot of considerations to be made before I'll drive into the path of the tornado. On the case of the Manchester tornado, the tornado was about a half a mile wide, and those very large tornadoes seem to track in a straight line. And there was one period of time when I was coming east, and I saw the Manchester tornado just before it went through the small town of Manchester, and I decided not to go in there because obviously it was getting too close, and I felt like I couldn't safely get in there, drop a couple of probes, and leave. So we moved north, and we got to a little more comfortable position, although that not much more comfortable, where the tornado was probably 300 yards in closing. We stopped and dropped another probe. At that point, when we left, the tornado was about 100 yards. And for me personally, that's really too close. I don't like them that close. But unfortunately, the roads dictate where I need to be, and sometimes I just don't have a choice. And so I have to sometimes exercise the choice of deploy or not deploy based on how far it is and forward speed and all those other little factors.
Can you describe for those of us who have never been, and most of us who never plan to be 100 yards away from a tornado, just what it's like? What is it that you're feeling or noticing that you might not have expected? I kind of hear the sound in my imagination, but I don't know about the rest of the experience.
Well, the sound, I mean, a lot of people describe it as a freight train, but I kind of describe it as a waterfall being powered by a jet engine, so to speak. When we made the drop, put the probe out in front of the Manchester tornado for the first time, both Pat Porter and myself were watching this tornado come from the south towards us, and we were watching telephone poles being snapped at the base and being drawn into the tornado vortex. And in front of the tornado, there was a herd of cows sort of running for their lives. And unfortunately, some of them didn't make it. The Geyer's farmhouse was something that we watched get completely destroyed. And it was moving on to the next farmhouse, which was only about 10 meters away from where we dropped our probe. So the feelings and everything involved there, it's hard to explain. A lot of exhilaration. A lot of very tense moments there. A lot of things can go wrong. As an example, my vehicle can get stuck. It can stall. Another dreadful thing that I consider, too, I rely on GPS mapping. I'll be driving down the road, perhaps with a tornado behind me. I'll come across a locked gate, and that's not good.
I'm sorry, guys. This is too close for me. I'm not going in there.
Too close?
That thing's a monster. It's a monster tornado.
Cross road is about a mile. That's where we're headed to. Careful, this road is very, very slick.
Is that your voice there, Tim? That's a monster?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it certainly was a monster. We were driving in solid rain moving east towards the storm. Our team, with Gene Roden and Karsten Peter, geographic photographer Karsten Peter behind us, as soon as the rain clears and that tornado came into full view, it was just an incredible sight. All the colors, the cloud formations, obviously the tornado was just an overwhelming experience. We pulled over and watched that. It was just, well, like I said, it was just a monster.
1-800-423-8255. Your chance to join our conversation this hour. We're talking about tornadoes and tornado chasing. Let's take a call from Boxborough, Massachusetts. Ken's on the line. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing? Fascinating show.
Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
I know you take a very scientific approach to the tornadoes, but I was wondering, you know, when you're in the presence of these things, you ever feel sort of almost a mystical, supernatural, even a transcendent feeling from these things, and that, you know, maybe we can't quite explain them scientifically?
That's a good question for you, Tim. Do you have time to think those thoughts?
Well, actually, certainly a lot of things are going through my mind. But unfortunately or fortunately, a lot of those have been crowded out by logistics. I've got the team members with me. I have my chase partner with me. When I stop, everybody seems to stop. So I feel like that, you know, some of their lives are sort of entrusting on some of my decisions. So a lot of those feelings, I'm sure, are there, but they get crowded out by logistics and going through the professional motions I must do to get the probes deployed and moved out of there. Certainly, I was able to watch and reflect once we got out of the harm's way, driving north up on the highway, and stood back and watched it and just sort of taking it all in. And I must say, it's quite a sight to behold.
Let's bring Stephen Levine into the conversation. Steve's joining us from Plano, Texas, where he is director of Tornado Alley Safaris. And Steve, I want to hear from you because my colleague Virginia tells me that you actually do take the time to think about the meaning of what's going on up there.
Yeah, actually, that's my main focus, or one of my main focuses. It's an experience of awe. And really an experience of connecting with what Matthew Fox calls sacred beauty and the Creator.
And is it because it's so violent and so destructive that you're drawn to it? Because I could use the description of what you just said to say, well, that's why I went to Niagara Falls last summer. But there's something more going on here.
Well, it's not the violence. See, I've been in, like the first person who was on, I've been in the weather since I was a toddler. And
Plano's your home, is it?
I'm sorry?
You grew up in Plano, did you?
No, actually, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
But since I was like 2 years old, weather had always been a source of magic to me. And, you know, with four seasons, all the aspects of weather, the storms, the exploding thunderheads, and of course I grew up where there was snow, so the snow and the dewdrops like rainbows in the grass, the lightning, all that stuff, it was like magic. And my fascination of storms increased as I grew older as a child. But it's not the violence, it's I would say the passion, the motion, the movement, the emotion. And in fact, my first conscious experience of God took place when I was six, when before supper, these really black, swirly clouds started rolling in, and I peeked out the door, and I thought to myself, so this is God.
And when you see some monster of a tornado bearing down on you from 500 or 600 yards away, I would ask you the same question I asked Tim Samaras. How do you have time to be contemplative in a situation like that?
Well, so far we haven't seen the wedge tornadoes. Ours have been smaller. But when we have seen them, it's like it's a combination of awe, almost what you might say altered reality, really. I mean, my clients, their voices will change. They'll go up two or three octaves in pitch.
That's raw fear. You know that,
No,
Steve.
It's awe. It's excitement. It's not fear. It's excitement and awe that we're actually seeing something like this. It's almost supernatural. And yet at the same time, you know, because I too have people whose lives are, you know, entrusted to me, I've got to be aware with all of my senses. I've got to keep looking around, seeing if anything else is developing. I've got to watch out for how close we are. You know, so it's like a total sensual experience. All the senses are on, and at the same time, profound awe.
Tell me something, Steve. You work part-time, part of the year as a substitute teacher, and then you do your touring with the Tornado Alley Safaris. What's your window here? You getting ready to go out on the road?
Yeah, I've got a couple tours planned for May this year, and actually, it's because of the day job situation and budget and everything, it's usually only two or three tours a year. And the rest of the year, in fact, I'm getting ready to get certified as a regular teacher this summer.
Meteorology, right?
I'd like to teach earth science, actually.
I think you'd be great at it. Steve, I want to thank you for being with us on the program.
Yeah, there's just, you know, could I say one other thing about the chasing here?
Go ahead.
Before I go. It's not just the tornadoes that we focus on the tour. One of my original visions when I put this together was to do for the sky what Jacques Cousteau had done for the waters, to introduce people to the possibility of slowing down, looking up, and celebrating the beauty that's there. And yes, storms are destructive,
right.
But then so are cars, and yet people see those as beautiful. But it's not just a tornado. I look at storms, I call myself a storm connoisseur. I look at storms the way birders look at birds. Tornadoes would be like seeing the bald eagle. But birders also get excited about other kinds of unusual, colorful, and exciting birds. Just seeing birds migrating every year is a sacred experience. And it's the same for me. Your typical, what they call garden variety of thunderstorm, to sit and watch the thunderheads explode from small cumulus clouds into a full-fledged storm in 45 minutes, to feel the passion of the clouds moving, to watch the first bolts of lightning dancing from the tops of the clouds down to the ground and hear the cracks of thunder and watch the evolution of the storm. On days when there's no tornadoes, we chase those kind of storms just for the sport of it and to see the beauty.
Steve, I got to let you go. We've got a number of people who want to join us on the line, so thanks for being with us. Steve Levine from Plano, Texas. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, your thoughts, your ideas, your notions about chasing tornadoes. To Apex, North Carolina, Steve's with us. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Great. Fascinating program. I had the experience in 2002. I was out in the Black Rock Desert, and I spent a few days out there with about 30,000 other people. And there was about 200 dust devils on this particular week that I was out there, at least 200 to 300, I'd say. And I had an opportunity to ride my bike on a flat surface, what they call the playa, and actually experience what it must feel like to be inside a tornado.
How big are these dust devils, Steve?
They range anything from, say, 3 to 4 feet to maybe 10 to 15 feet in diameter. And it's fascinating to be able to ride and catch one and to ride up and to look up into the vortices. I've always been fascinated with tornadoes, and I'm fascinated with the topic today. I just was wondering if a dust devil is any kind of close similarity to what a tornado would be.
I don't know. Tim Samaras, do you use dust devils as kind of like training grounds for tornadoes?
Well, actually, no. But, you know, there are some similarities between a dust devil and a tornado because both of them are a vortex. And both dust devils and tornadoes, because of the rotational wind speeds around them, they actually have a pressure drop. If you put a very sensitive barometer or carried one with you and you took it through a dust devil, you might see maybe a 2 millibar pressure drop inside of a dust devil. It's all the same kind of mechanism that's creating them.
All right, Steve, thanks for your call. Another from Concord, Massachusetts. Tom's with us. Hi, Tom.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And a quick story and a question. I was in a small tornado in North Texas back in the 70s. It was right around the time the real damaging one at Wichita Falls happened. My question was concerning the sky. We didn't know what was happening. It was a small one, and the light was very, very unusual. And just quickly, as a northerner, never having been in one, I looked out, very stormy, very windy. The garbage pails were flying down the street. I looked out again, and they were going the other way, and something wasn't right.
It's a great question, Tim, and that's Tom. I want to turn it to Tim. Tim, the colors that you photograph and describe in the sky are really like nothing else.
Yeah, well, that's right. You know, there's quite a beauty in with these supercell storms. You have green and blue and red hues to them. The color of the sky, mainly green, is coming from refraction from rain and possibly hail in the inside. And that sort of gives you an idea of how severe perhaps the storms are. But as far as identifying the storms that are up in the air, whether or not they're going to produce a tornado or not, is rather difficult. One should always seek shelter, of course, when these type of storms come by, because not only do they create tornadoes, they certainly create deadly lightning, which is one of the number one killers with thunderstorms.
My brother lives in Iowa City and was describing to me a day when the whole sky turned green. And in fact, they were sitting by a restaurant window at the time, and the proprietor said, "Time to get away from the window." Is the green sky a real sort of short-term warning or a long-term warning, Tim?
Well, certainly the green sky tells you that the thunderstorm is heavily laden with rain and or hail, and it was good advice to get away from the window in case it does drop very large hail.
Now, the other thing that you guys drop, is, aside from these little turtles, the round discs we were talking about, one is a Tin Man, I think. Is that the proper name for it, the little pyramid with the cameras inside?
Well, that's what the team called it. It's a probe built by the National Geographic magazine. It had several cameras on the inside of it, and Karsten Peter and Gene Roden, another veteran chaser that was along with us, pulled the probe out and dropped it in its path of the tornado bearing down on us. And unfortunately, as the tornado came up to the probe, it basically picked up the probe and threw it about 200 to 300 yards. But before it did, it snapped a couple of pictures before the probe was destroyed, which are published in the National Geographic magazine, and what are known to be probably the closest pictures ever of a tornado. And these cameras are looking straight up, which means you're basically looking at the base of the funnel, looking straight up and capturing part of the debris. It's really quite spectacular. Unfortunately, the probe was destroyed, and all the cameras broke loose on the inside, and they were all just kind of rattling around in there. Some of the cameras weren't saved, but a couple of them were, and were able to dissect them to get the film out.
Actually, the people at Ultimate Explorer National Geographic who were involved in helping gather those photographs have given us access to some of them. You can see them on our website. They aren't quite as perhaps as dramatic as they appear in the glossy pages of a National Geographic, but they sure give you a sense of the power and what's going on inside those tornadoes. So, Connection listeners, we're talking about the beauty and the mystery of these things. We should also talk a little bit about their destructive power. We'll do that when we come back. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I have an appointment with a woman on a bicycle. I have to go. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour is Tim Samaras. He is a senior research engineer featured in the April National Geographic magazine cover story, Chasing Tornadoes, a tale of science, guts, and luck. And the people at Ultimate Explorer National Geographic have given us some of those images from that article. They're on our website. We are at theconnection.org. If you'd like to look at those, if you want to talk to Tim, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Ed's joining us now. Ed, thanks for waiting.
Sure. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. Have you seen one of these tornadoes up close yourself?
Well, unfortunately, yeah. In fact, I've been in the middle of one, and that's a kind of a perspective I wanted to pass on. It was 30 years ago. We are about to come across the 30th anniversary of April 3rd, 1974, where in, I believe, it's Kentucky, Tennessee, and Indiana, there were a string of deadly tornadoes, killed actually hundreds of people, did tremendous amounts of damage. I was in a building in Louisville where, and this, remember, this was actually before Doppler radar and those kind of things. We weren't really very familiar with what a tornado was. Basically, the building exploded around us without us having any idea what was going on. We actually kind of ran out of the building after we realized that most of us had not been hurt severely and still did not know what was going on. But I guess my point is that, you know, while I find them fascinating still, too, it certainly changed my life forever. It ended several people's lives, many people's lives those days. And the people who are out there, I guess, chasing these storms and, you know, in awe of them and exclaiming over them when they come across them, I just want to make the point that, remember, it's very possible that while it's beautiful, it may be taking somebody's life or certainly at the very least their property at the same time.
Tim, I guess this is something on your mind when you're out there as well.
Oh, absolutely. And it's certainly the research and some of the data that we're recording from the probes will help us bring a piece to the puzzle in our understanding of the tornado vortex and the type of damages that it does. And that's what I certainly keep in mind as it goes. And I'm also a ham radio operator as well. And I participate in the local, what we call skywarn nets, which means that if we see tornadoes, we basically either get on the cellular telephone or the radio, or the ham radio, and we report our findings and so that the National Weather Service can put out the warning. So we're out there trying to give adequate warning as well.
I wonder, Ed, whether or not your attitude about tornadoes has changed at all now that there is that Doppler radar, there are the networks of warning. I mean, I understand that the average warning time for most tornadoes is still under 20 minutes. To say, hey, there's one coming, take cover. But whether or not there's a part of you that thinks maybe we take too much comfort in what technology can help prevent.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that I certainly have a much more healthy respect for them and for my family than I ever did before. You know, there is some twisted kind of a logic in thinking, I guess, that if you've ever been in one of these things, they're really truly in the middle of one, that your chances of being in another one are pretty slim.
Yeah.
Probably not safe logic, but I'm very careful and I take no chances. And for a couple of years after this, remember I was a 10-year-old kid, but literally for a couple of years I slept in a basement, and there was a sense of kind of a post-traumatic stress that went along with it. So if you're fortunate enough not to be injured or killed, it certainly stays with you forever.
I thank you for your reminder. I think it was a timely one.
All right, thank you.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our next call from Fairfax, Virginia. Ben's on the line. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine.
My interest is mostly in scientifically understanding these storms and phenomena. I'm wondering, as part of my question of how realistic the movie Twister was with the idea of planting the many sensors in the storm, what variables we currently measure and what measures we don't currently sensor at the simultaneously to more fully understand the phenomena.
Well, let's take the first part and ask Tim to help us out with that. Do you watch Twister as a reasonable representation of what goes on near a tornado?
Well, I've seen the movie Twister when it came out in 1996. Most of it certainly is Hollywood. A lot of terminology they use is incorrect. The big probe that they have called Dorothy was actually patterned after a real one named Toto back in the early 80s that was constructed by Dr. Al Bedard and others to be placed directly in the path of the tornado. There was a few differences between the Hollywood version and the real one. The real one did not eject little plastic balls into the tornado, and it basically tried to measure basic meteorological conditions within a tornado. It weighed about 300 pounds, and it took a couple of guys to offload it in the truck. In fact, your guest, Dr. Lou Wicker, you had on earlier, was one of the team members of that mission here many moons ago.
And just to the second part of Ben's question, the type of information that you're trying to gather, we've talked about drops in pressure, we've talked about photographs. Is there that one little missing diamond of information which is going to kind of tell us a whole lot about the source or direction or behavior of tornadoes that we don't know, or is it a matter of just sort of like incrementally gathering as much of the bits and pieces as we can, Tim?
Well, actually, there is several bits and pieces of information we really would like to gather. One of the bits of information that we're trying to gather and we're looking at is to gather actual wind speed at various heights along the surface. We do not have any information or any equipment, instrumentation that tells us anything about the wind speed at, say, a height of 1 meter or maybe 5 meters. A lot of the Doppler radar that scientists are using simply can't look down that low along the ground surface. So a lot of the information along the surface remain to be discovered and measured. And that's unfortunately where a lot of the damage takes place, and the wind engineers would dearly love to have that data.
All right, let's go to Boston, Massachusetts next, and Craig's joining us. Hi, Craig.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I had a couple questions, but I'm going to be doing a storm chase at the end of this month out in Oklahoma. I'm a journalist, and basically I've just been cleared to go do this, and I've never actually seen a tornado. However, I've spent my whole life with reoccurring dreams of tornadoes. And I've met a lot of other people who in the field have had these dreams and whatnot, and I was just curious, too, if Tim himself has had any of these tornado dreams being haunted his whole life by them.
There you go, Tim.
Well, you know, believe it or not, I do have tornado dreams. I mean, if it's part of your work, you're going to often dream about it. If you're, you know, if you fall asleep thinking about a certain problem or an issue that you're going to solve, somehow it gets mixed up and twisted in a dream. So certainly I dream about them. Sometimes I don't want to wake up.
What's your advice to Craig heading out on his first storm search? What's the one piece of advice that you'd pass along as an expert?
Are you going with a tour group? Or are you going out by yourself?
I'm going to be following a storm chase. He's written one book, Tornado Tim. He's given me the okay to follow behind him. And I'm a bit nervous doing it, but yet intrigued.
Okay, that would probably be my number one piece of advice, is to go with somebody that has done it for a number of years so that they're experienced. One of the biggest hazards is going out there if you do not know how to chase, don't know what to look for. Being out there, you can get yourself in trouble rather quickly. So it sounds like you're doing the number one piece of advice that I would give.
All right, Craig.
To have somebody with you.
Keep your head down, Craig. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. And next to Boston, Massachusetts, Nancy's with us. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
I'm glad you called. I was beginning to think it was only boys who like talking about tornadoes.
Well, I was actually a junior in high school when the 1974 tornado that Ted described came through. My hometown is Xenia, Ohio, and it was destroyed. That was an F5 tornado.
Wow.
And I guess I'd have to agree with Ed that having, you know, seen the destruction and seen the post-trauma that people, I still know lots of people with, who are traumatized by that experience. And, you know, I question a little bit the idea of, you know, doing storm chasing as a tour kind of thing. I mean, for scientific reasons, I think it's great. We certainly have a lot to learn. I also have a question for your guest.
Well, hold your question for half a sec, Nancy, because I want to ask Tim about that. There was a time, was there not, Tim, when storm chasing was kind of looked down on, when it was thought to be, I don't know, somewhat disrespectful of Mother Nature?
Well, I'm not so sure that there was a time where storm chasing was looked down upon. Certainly, local law enforcement would look down upon storm chasing. There's a certain amount of chasers out there who drive recklessly, exceed the speed limit, and endangering other people's lives just trying to drive to the storm. But certainly the storm chasing got its big boost in 1996, where a lot of people went out and watched the movie Twister and took it upon themselves as, hey, there really are people out there watching and driving hundreds and thousands of miles to watch these storms. It kind of pulled it out of the closet, along with the PBS Nova series Tornado that was aired back in 1986.
I think Nova's got another piece that they're running tonight as well, which is going to feature Dr. Lou Wicker, who was a guest on the program as well. So if you're one of those people who still watches television, you can keep an eye open for that. Nancy, I stopped you before you were going to ask a question. What is that?
Well, actually, during the Xenia tornado, I was actually not in the middle of it. I was about a mile away from it when it occurred. But something that happened even where I lived was that the air took on this incredible orange color, and everything went very, very still. And I just wondered if your guest, I've always wondered about that. What was that about? You know, I wondered if he could enlighten me a little bit about what that was about.
Well, I'm a little mystified to the orange color. It could be that it was drawing some smoke or something from a nearby fire, maybe damage caused by the tornadoes beforehand. The tornadoes themselves, when they form and they're on the ground, especially the very powerful ones, have got a very, very fast, what we call a low-level jet, and it could be drawing air from another area. As far as air being still, I mean, it depends on exactly where you are in relation to the tornado. I've seen lots of tornadoes occur or touch down where the wind would be blowing maybe 60 to 80 miles an hour. Then I've seen tornadoes where the air was almost perfectly still. So it depends on the conditions, it depends on the storm, and depends on where you're standing in relation to the tornado.
Was there a lot of dust in the air then, Nancy? Do you remember?
No, it was incredibly still and quiet. It was just like a moment of peace that was very remarkable. That I looked out my window and said, "Wow, what is this about?" And I had no idea at that time that there was a tornado very close by.
Well, it sounded like something that stuck well in your memory, Nancy.
I'll never forget.
Thanks a lot for calling.
That's for sure. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
To Northampton, Massachusetts, Rick's joining us. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Sort of an unusual question maybe, but in reading that article, the National Geographic, and seeing the pictures, came to mind that there are a lot of, I guess, foolish people out there that do things like go over the Niagara Falls without anything surrounding them. And I'm wondering if your guest knows of anyone who has ever tried to maybe develop some kind of a pod or something and actually try and get in the middle of a tornado. And the second part of my question was, is there a record for someone who's actually lived having been lifted up in a tornado and dropped at another location? That's it.
Well, to answer your first question, there are, believe it or not, a couple of individuals that are making a vehicle to survive a direct hit of a tornado. And they're going to be out there this spring. And certainly something that I wouldn't recommend doing. And the second part of your question, let's see.
People picked up and thrown around? I've read stories about that.
Yes. If you go to the website, tornadoproject.com, there's all kinds of oddities of tornadoes picking up things, pieces, and people, and it probably has a lot of information as far as records in there goes. I don't know them offhand, but I do understand there's some rather amazing tales out there to be told.
Now, Tim, you're in a studio in New York City. When do you get back to Tornado Alley?
I'm I'm flying back to Colorado tonight and keeping a watchful eye on the weather over the next month or so. My new expedition will start May 1st. I'm going to be out in the field solid for 2 months on the hunt for large tornadoes.
Be careful.
Thanks.
Tim Samaras is a tornado chaser and senior research engineer for Applied Research Associates. Earlier in the program, we talked with Dr. Lou Wicker at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We also talked with Stephen Levine, director of Tornado Alley Safaris and Tornado Chaser. David Lewis, and I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.